Hey everybody, Brian McClanahan here. The woke madness in history education is off the rails. Well, how do we change it? McClanahanacademy.com. And because you listen to this podcast, if you use the coupon code PODCAST at checkout, you get 25% off every day, all day, 365 days a year on every class at McClanahanacademy.com. So go to McClanahanacademy.com, use coupon code PODCAST at checkout, and get a real history education at 25% off. If you like this podcast and you want it without advertisements, head over to patreon.com and become a member of the Brian McClanahan Show. For $10 a month, you get all the podcasts ad-free, including video, and you also get a special Q&A podcast. I'm only going to answer your questions, your listener-generated episodes, through those Q&A. So, head over to patreon.com. Get this podcast ad-free, no ads, not even things like this, and you really do help support the Brian McClanahan Show with really cool stuff on the back end. The Founding Fathers are under attack. Who knew in 2009, when I wrote my first book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Founding Fathers, that George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and a litany of the other Founding Fathers would be under assault today? Well, I did, and that's why I wrote that book. It's my first, it's still my bestseller. Going out and pick it up whenever books are sold online. The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Founding Fathers. You'll really enjoy it. Is there a historical precedent for the kind of fictional Civil War movie that we're all enjoying right now in America? Well, yes. We'll talk about that on this episode of The Brian McClanahan Show.
It's time to think locally and act locally. Welcome to The Brian McClanahan Show.
Welcome back to the Brian McClanahan Show. Glad to be back on the program. Very glad to be here. All right. Well, I talked about the movie yesterday, Civil War, and I gave you my review of the movie. But let's talk about the precedent for this, not the what-ifs, not all the stuff, you know, what happened, what if secession, what does it do, the Lincolnian America, and all that stuff. But the way that Americans have thought about division, dividing up the Union, through fiction. And there's a really interesting piece in Slate by a man named Richard Kreitner. Now, I've talked about Kreitner on this show before. He wrote a book just a few years back entitled Break It Up. He's a leftist, but he does understand the historical context of these secession movements. In fact, that's what the entire book is about. All of these different American secession movements. He really did a good job going out and finding a lot of these that are pretty much unknown. So I want to focus on his piece because he does bring in all of this literature that was produced in about a 30-year period, and then immediately after the war, there's some other literature as well. It didn't die out. Just because the war ended didn't mean people dropped this notion of dividing up the Union and what that would mean, particularly for minority groups. He even brings up a piece of fiction written by Black Americans who are still talking about dividing up America when the war was over. It's something that I reference in my class on secession at McClanahan Academy. I also have the class reading secession where I don't get into this fictional stuff. I do other things with it. But these accounts, these fictional accounts are interesting because it shows you what Americans were thinking about at the time. Literature often reflects the popular sentiment, or at least the sentiment of some individuals. And this is where I shudder to think what people are going to do when they start looking at the literature of America in the last 50 years or so and what people are writing. I mean, there is some decent literature, but most of it's not very good. So, and then if you look at the art that's being produced by Americans, whether it's modern art or some of the film, I mean, again, some of it's good, but a lot of it is pretty bad. What does that say about American society and American culture? What does it say where American values are centered or how Americans are thinking about the world? And Civil War, the modern film, does reflect that. I mean, look, 30 years ago, let's go back 30 years, you'd have been hard-pressed to find many people in America who were talking about secession, a type of division, to think about a section or a group of states or one state leaving the Union. That had been settled, it was thought, by the war. Now, it didn't mean, again, that there weren't people thinking about these things after the war was over, but to have a large public expression of that, impossible. Not today. 25 years later, 30 years later, say 30 years later, 30 years later, we're going to 1994. 30 years later, you've got groups in many states, California, Texas, Alaska, Hawaii. You've got larger pushes for regionalism that are interested in this prospect of secession, or at least what it could potentially look like. You've got people in the West Coast. You've got people in the middle of the United States. I mean, within Texas, you also have Oklahoma. People in Oklahoma interested in that. You've got interest in it in New England, in the South. You have secession movements around the United States, and not just here in the U.S., this very Jeffersonian principle of decentralization, or what we should say is an American principle, has also found currency across the pond. You've got interest in it in parts of Europe. Whether it's in Spain and in the United Kingdom. So this is big. When you start looking at people and self-determination, it becomes a very important part of our dialogue. And when you have fiction, when you have art centered on that, it opens up the dialogue even further. That's what I think is remarkable about the film. Now, I think that they did some things wrong, and some people have criticized it for not really getting into the why. Even Kreitner is very critical of the film because he thinks people are going to miss it, and it's just going to be like a video game, and oh, this is fun and cool. I don't think you get that. And the reaction I had from the people that were in the film, when I could hear some people saying some things, somebody was saying, this is cool, or that's amazing. I think the shock was there. I think that the director, Garland, did a good job of showing the shock of the violence. This wasn't good. The violence wasn't neat. It was something that was to be avoided. Something to be condemned. But you did have all of those things I talked about in the film that were, I think, larger. And again, people would miss it just on the surface. I think Kreitner even misses some of the things that are going on in the film. Or at least he just doesn't write about them. I haven't had a conversation about it, but he doesn't write about it. So let's get into the piece. It's entitled, The Actual Civil War Was Also Preceded by Fiction That Imagined What If America Had a Civil War? Again, this is in Slate Magazine. He begins by saying, the year is 1849. Martin Van Buren has just been sworn in for his fourth term as president. Now, what's interesting about that, in the film, and I didn't mention this in my review, the president of the United States is actually up for a third term. There is maybe this notion that what forced the war was you had a president who was looking to stick in the White House beyond two terms. And it's kind of a vanilla character. You're looking more to Mike Pence than a Donald Trump. But this is the fear of the left. What if Trump gets in there again? What if he wins in 2024 if he's not convicted of some trumped up charge, no pun intended, and he's not thrown in jail in the next month? But what if, some political witch hunt doesn't work? What if Trump gets in 2024 and then in 2029 he doesn't want to leave? What would happen then? Would you have some type of civil war? So in 1849, this fear, or at least this book is being written in 1836, but this fear of in the 30s that you're going to have a dictator. Now, the timing, of course, of that is important. Who is president in 1836? It wasn't Martin Van Buren. It was Andrew Jackson. And what was happening in the United States at this particular time period? You had Jackson being called King Andrew across South Carolina and in other parts of the South. You had Jackson's supporters who were recoiling at his excessive use of executive power. This led to the Whig Party. So, what if that was the case? Martin Van Buren, Van Buren wasn't going to do that, but Jackson would have. And by Tucker, who wrote this book, deflecting off of Jackson and on to Van Buren. Of course, Van Buren's from New York, Jackson from the South. You're making this into a more sectional issue. But Jackson was the one they feared. I mean, Jackson had been elected. This was, you know, finishing up his second term in 1836. Van Buren was going to be coming into office in 1837. But Jackson was the model. So the piece continues, every state from the Carolinas on south secedes from the Union. The U.S. Army occupies Richmond to keep Virginia from joining them. Separatists take to the western mountains and organize a guerrilla campaign. In Washington, Van Buren assumes dictatorial powers, hangs traitors on a whim. The sons of the Old Dominion have to choose between the Union they have been raised to admire and the state they deeply adore. An intriguing alternate history? Not quite. The novel in which this story appears flourished forward in time, not back. Flashed forward in time, not back. Well, actually, it did both. Published in 1836, but with the date of the title pages of 1856, as if remembering a war that had already occurred, the partisan leader, A Tale of the Future, didn't so much relate a different version of the Civil War as prophecy is coming, missing the eventual start date by only a dozen years. That makes it the little-known granddaddy of a whole subgenre of American literature, and now film. Blood-drenching imaginations of what it would be like to witness the crack-up of the country. Americans have always been at once horrified and titillated by the prospect of these states becoming disunited. If the U.S. is an imagined community, as the anthropologist Benedict Anderson described the modern nation-state, one of the things its citizens most love to imagine is its violent undoing. Now, again, what is the point, though? The undoing isn't so much violence. It's what the response would be from the central authority. When Tucker wrote this, the states leaving wasn't the act of violence. The response from the center was always the act of violence. And that's what happened here. Van Buren hanging traitors, sending in the army, seizing Richmond. In other words, the forcible prevention of secession is what people are worrying about and how this would work. And there's a warning shot there. This doesn't have to be this way. And when you go back and read The Partisan Leader, I'm going to get into it because he makes some mistakes about that book. And I'll talk about that just for a second. It wasn't a glorification of these things. Now, later, Edmund Ruffin would do that, but it wasn't a glorification of any of this stuff. In fact, it's a warning. Don't do this. Not secession, but don't have this kind of response. Lately, even more so than usual, a profound sense of decline and disintegration has come to define the national mood. How obvious, then, even inevitable, to pair this primordial form of American catastrophism with the evidently deathless genre of big-budget disaster movies. Americans fighting Americans, the country falling apart, the breakdown of civic order. What could be more popcorn-worthy than that? Dystopian situations are more popular, I think, in the last half century. There's a lot of reasons for that. Some of that came out of nuclear war. Of course, the boredom, I think, that set in decadent America, that's certainly a part of it. But the zombie films, and that, of course, comes out of, you know, biological warfare, nuclear warfare. What happens if we had nukes and people turn into zombies and all kinds of things? I mean, this is certainly, you know, part and parcel of all of this. What happens if we have these things? And what happens if this beautiful situation we all enjoy of Western civilization, the decadence, the comfort, the security, what happens if all that breaks down? Americans are very secure. How could that happen? This is something people do think about. As a genre, disunion fantasy fiction has often showcased bad politics and even worse art. The hypothetical scenarios of such works tend to be hilariously implausible, the author's intentions murky at best, or sometimes clearly mercenary. Even in this context, however, Alex Garland's much-ballyhooed Civil War stands out for its eagerness to exploit popular fears of mass political violence without offering any meaningful reflection on the underlying factors that have led to it. Again, that's the critique. He doesn't get into the why. He just gets into the violence. But I think in some of that, it was to make a point about what this could be of a disunited America, of Americans so polarized that they're willing to take out and do these things to each other just because. Just because. And I think that's a critique, or at least a comment, on modern American society. Secession does not have to be this way. And I think Kreitner knows that. It's why he's saying there's no underlying factors, there's no discussion of these things. Kreitner understands that secession didn't have to be the way that it was, and there were people that were promoting it for peaceful reasons. A live and let live scenario. He knows that. Experience it in IMAX, the promotional poster urges, in a tone that sits uncomfortably with the director's claim that he made the film as a warning of what could occur if we're not careful. So he's saying, of course, this is sensational. It's a sensational thing. And that doesn't fit with what he's saying. It's a warning. He's trying to make money on the violence. Maybe. I don't know. I don't think that's... I mean, people are going to watch it. Right. And it is going to be visually stunning in some ways. And I think not stunning in a way of... You know, that's awe-inspiring, but that's horrible. And there is that part of it. If the past is any guide, such macabre depictions of what Edmund Wilson called patriotic gore may only accustom us to the likelihood that it will. No. I don't think so. Obsessing about a potential future civil war was a favorite activity of Americans in the years before they ventured into the field to murder one another en masse. As the crisis over slavery deepened, this is where he kind of uses the term crisis over slavery as it was a moral crusade on one side or the other. And he even makes a mistake with the first book, The Partisan Leader. Tucker's Partisan Leader. He says it's all about slavery, which I'll get into that in a minute. A bumper crop of new novels depicted a Southern breakaway movement and a bloody conflict with the North. The book's authors tended not to deplore the possibility, but to welcome it. They wanted readers to envision, from the safety of their armchairs, what the destruction of the nation would look like and to help bring it on. The Partisan Leader, though published under a pseudonym, was widely known to be the work of a Virginian named Nathaniel Beverly Tucker, a son of the slaveocracy who taught at the College of William and Mary. Now, the Tuckers, let's just talk about the Tuckers, right? The son of a slaveocracy. His father was St. George Tucker. St. George Tucker was an emancipationist, if not an abolitionist. His stepbrother, John Randolph of Roanoke, freed all of his slaves. Now, Nathaniel Beverly Tucker, he went by Beverly Tucker. Nathaniel Beverly Tucker's brother, Henry St. George Tucker, was also a professor at William & Mary. Served in Congress, served in the Virginia Court of Appeals. And all of the Tuckers talked about the Union and the original Constitution. St. George Tucker wrote a book entitled View of the Constitution of the United States, where he went through the Constitution and explained what it meant. And it was the compact fact, the first real commentary on the Constitution ever written in America, and it discusses the compact fact of the Constitution. So to say this is a son of the slaveocracy is to be very disingenuous. In fact, it's outright stupid. This is Kreitner, I've had conversations before. He's a leftist, far leftist. And that's fine if you're going to be accurate in how you portray things. This is disingenuous and inaccurate. And that's where I would call him out for this. All the rest of this, yeah, fine, sure. This is being disingenuous. And landed sooner than most Southerners on the conclusion that secession offered the only guarantee for the continuation of Southern institutions, slavery above all. No. In fact, when you go to read The Partisan Leader, the word slavery is mentioned 3 times in the entire book. You know what he does say in the book? The original states seceded because of unconstitutional tariffs. Now, put it within the context of 1836. What had we just had? Well, the nullification crisis. We had just had a president say he's going to use the military to collect the tariff. And that, according to Tucker, is what drove the Deep South states out of the Union. What drove Virginia out of the Union? Well, the occupation of Richmond by the federal government. Now, Tucker also wrote another piece, several other things. He actually wrote a book entitled George Balcom, which Edgar Allan Poe called the best American novel ever written. And Poe was pretty high on Tucker as a writer, also his works of fiction. Over at the Abbey Institute, we published an 1839 treatise entitled Discourse on the Genius of the Federative Systems of the United States, where Tucker talks about federalism. Now, Kreitner says, as early as 1820, Tucker swore never to rest until he saw the Union shattered into pieces. A professor of law at William & Mary for nearly 20 years, Tucker trained a generation of Southern leaders in how to think about the Constitution. Later, his students would lead their states out of the Union, just as Tucker had hoped. Well, I mean, yeah, he had contacts with people like John Tyler and Abel Upchur. His brother, was also on the law faculty at the University of Virginia at one point. So, I mean, but these people were interested in federalism. They came from that tradition. And it wasn't just because of slavery. As Tucker points out, as Kreitner says, Tucker said, no, that's being disingenuous. But Tucker's ambitions as an educator went beyond formal instruction. Turning to fiction and using the novels of Walter Scott as a model, he wanted to help Southerners imagine how the breakup of the Union might happen and to show where their loyalties should lie if it did. Duff Green, a prominent Washington publisher and close ally of South Carolina Senator John C. Calhoun, printed 2,000 copies of the book in 2 volumes. The Southern Literary Messenger, an influential periodical then edited by Edgar Allan Poe, who corresponded with Tucker and sought advice from him, praised the artistry and plausibility of the novel, as well as its argument for Southern resistance to federal tyranny. Quote, "The reader rises from the perusal of the book with solemn impressions of the probable truth of all the writer's speculations, and he naturally asks himself by what means the evils he has seen depicted may be prevented." Well, to adhere to the Constitution, that's how they would be prevented. To not try to go and serve 3 terms or to abuse the Constitution and abuse the powers of government, like, I don't know, Andrew Jackson. Northern journalists ignored the scandalous work and booksellers refused to stock it, but the Partisan Leader found new relevance, a quarter century later, with the secession of the seven southernmost states. In 1861, a New York publisher reprinted the book with the title A Key to the Disunion Conspiracy. The novel seemed to have predicted the future. Events were following Tucker's script. Seizing on Tucker's prescient vision, the other writers saw a market for similar works. Only now they added elaborately detailed portrayals of interstate violence, the CGI of the time. So, Kreitner is correct. Tucker's book is pretty dry. There's none of this wild, imagined wartime scenes. I mean, there are some things, but there's political discussions in the book that center on, I don't know, the original Constitution and the abuse of power. It's not about slavery. Like I said, it's mentioned 3 times in the book. 3 times. In 1859, John Beauchamp Jones, a successful Maryland novelist, also once praised by Poe, published Wild Southern Scenes, a tale of disunion and border war. 13 Southern states abandoned Congress and sent an army to occupy New York City and abduct free black people and bring them back as slaves. A villainous Northern general proclaims himself Lord Protector of the United States, invades the South, and wields the guillotine to gruesome effect. Great Britain leaps into the fray, keen to take advantage of the chaos and reclaim its lost colonies. North and South join together to expel the foreign foe. The Constitution is restored. Now, this is, as the title suggests, Wild Southern Scenes. And it's an entirely different look. The Southern states were not going to invade New York City. But again, it's part of this imagination. What could happen here or there? This is not what did happen in any way. A New York-based businessman's magazine found the book full of ingenuity and invention and hoped it would have the effect of opening the eyes of the more conservative to the terrible results that will follow from the sectional madness and folly now disturbing the country. Now, see? What was the point? It was to show this is a bad idea. Now, Kreitner's point is, well, yeah, that's what these people wanted, but what we got was people thinking this is a good idea. By contrast, Edmund Ruffin, an eccentric, long-maned agricultural reformer from Virginia and a passionate advocate of Southern separatism, thought Jones' book very foolish, especially its feel-good ending, and decided he could do better. The result, Anticipations of the Future, 1860, was both impressively timely and remarkably unhinged. The novel, serialized in a pro-secession South Carolina newspaper, then packaged as a book by a top Southern publisher, took the form of fictional dispatches by a correspondent to an English newspaper about a crisis following the Lower South secession from the Union. To suppress the rebellion, the President of the United States, New York's William Seward, sends an army into Virginia, prompting the rest of the slave states to leave. A gruesome fight ensues, climaxing with the wholesome slaughter of mixed-race Northern armies described by Ruffin in gory detail. The abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison is hanged, his corpse defiled by vultures. Meanwhile, the Western states secede and join the rebellion. Northern cities go up in smoke, leaving many thousands of charged and partly consumed skeletons. I mean, it's a horribly violent depiction of what could happen if the North lost. Of course, Southerners were thinking that would be a good idea. But you put Seward, some of the things that are interesting about this book. Number one, Seward, who had his higher law speech, was more conservative and perhaps would have been better as president than Lincoln, because there's a speculation that Seward would have tried to negotiate longer and more forcibly than Lincoln did. There's that. But you think about Garrison, and of course Ruffin's attack on Garrison and some of the abolitionists. Abolitionists were despised, not just in Virginia, but throughout the North. These people were seen as dangerous. Remember, abolitionists ran out of town, their schools burned down, their newspapers shut down. I mean, Northerners didn't like these people because they thought they were the rabble-rousers. They were going to cause all kinds of problems. But one of the things the North also said, and Ruffin talks about mixed-race Northern armies, Republicans actually called the South the land of miscegenation, not the North. It was the North that would have the pure white race, and the South would have been interested in mixed-race peoples. That was the argument against the South. We don't want to be in a union with these mixed-race peoples, these mulattoes running around everywhere. So it's interesting how race does factor into both sides of this at times, and how they viewed each side as being interested in the mixing of the races, one or the other. Writing these scenes, Ruffin confided in his diary, it was alike amusing to my mind and conducive to immediate pleasure. Only about 400 readers bothered to pick up Ruffin's overwrought novel, much to the author's chagrin. That might have been because the future he anticipated was already becoming a reality. In the novel, South Carolina seizes Fort Sumter and Charleston Harbor, just where the actual fighting would begin only months after the publication of Ruffin's book, when the 67-year-old author, a volunteer with the militia, was himself given the high honor of firing one of the first shots in the war he had fantasized about with such pleasure. Now, Sumter, of course, remember, no casualties until the day after. No one was killed. They were told the fort it was going to be fired on, and nobody was killed in that. The unfathomable devastation that ensued, leaving 750,000 dead, hundreds of thousands more wounded in body and mind, and much of the South a smoldering ruin, took the fun out of imagining what a nation-rending conflict would look like. The genre disappeared for a time. Ruffin shot himself in the head after the surrender at Appomattox. The reality of Southern secession hadn't matched up to the turgid fantasies of his fiction. And this is where I think Kreitner is best, in finding some of these other things that nobody really knows anything about. In the decades after the Civil War, expectations of national division over slavery were replaced by fears that mass immigration would undermine American unity. In 1880, Canadian-born San Francisco lawyer and journalist Puritan W. Dooner published Last Days of the Republic, which depicted a Chinese army overthrowing the Pacific states and marching east all the way to Washington. Quote, the very name of the United States of America was thus blotted from the records of nations and peoples. Perhaps one of the strangest disunion fantasy novels ever published was Imperium in Imperio by Sutton E. Griggs, a 27-year-old preacher and son of formerly enslaved parents. The novel revolves around a secret government of, by, and for black Americans based in a bunker beneath a Texas college. This is 1899. Devoted to racial progress and fighting discrimination, the Imperium recruits a rising generation of ambitious, educated black men who have grown frustrated at being denied the most basic rights and privileges of citizenship. They grew to hate the flag that would float in an undisturbed manner over such a condition of affairs, Griggs writes. They began to abuse and execrate a national government that would not protect them against color prejudice, but on the contrary, actually practice it itself. Ooh, this novel is interesting. What's going on here? The United States government is not really protecting former slaves. And this is a position that many people on the left took because of the abandonment of Reconstruction. So, after a black postmaster was lynched in South Carolina, an event that really happened a year before Griggs published his novel, the Imperium decides to take Austin and declare war on the United States. Thus, the president of the Imperium proclaims, will the Negro have an empire of his own? There were other black separatist students. I talked about Pap Singleton, who had a black separatist movement in Kansas, trying to get away from both the Union, which he didn't think was protecting them either, and of course the South. These things were happening. People were thinking about the value of Union, calculating the value of Union for a variety of reasons. In the turmoil of the 60s and 70s, breeding a new wave of concern about national failure and societal collapse led to another boomlet in fictional depictions of the United States. Cracking up, the Texas-Israeli War, 1999, written by sci-fi authors Jake Saunders and the late Howard Waldrop at the peak of the 1973 oil crisis, depicted the reestablishment of the independent Lone Star Republic in a world torn apart by biological and chemical warfare. Texans kidnap the American president, mercenaries from the Jewish state attempt to rescue him. On Wings of Song, 1979, by Thomas Dish, portrayed an America destroyed by economic inequality and culture war, divided between a liberal Babylon on the coasts and a semi-autonomous conservative region, Colombia, in the heartland, populated by undergooders, an astute depiction of the rural-urban divide that will only worsen in the coming years. In Margaret Atwood's now canonical The Handmaid's Tale, a turn to religious fundamentalism brings a second civil war and the rise of a theocratic women-enslaving dictatorship. Yeah, I mean, of course, I haven't watched it, but there was a series on this. This is the lefties. Think about what's happening here. All of these books, the 1960s and 70s, or most of these books, are written by left-wingers who are afraid of the right. Even Civil War is that. Charlottesville is front and center. What they all miss, of course, is that most of secession would be peaceful if there wasn't a firm response from the general government. A few novels rejected dystopian warnings in favor of, like the antebellum Southern writers, actually proposing disunion as an improvement on the status quo, a stance shared by authors of vastly different political stripes. Ecotopia, a 1975 novel by the environmentalist Ernest Kallenbach, imagined the establishment of a separatist West Coast republic whose residents live in dynamic, sustainable harmony with one another and with nature. While far on the other side of the political divide, William Luther Pierce's The Turner Diaries, 1978, records the events of the Great Revolution of 1991 to 99, in which black people, Jews, and other non-Aryans are slaughtered and white race traitors hanged from lampposts. Seizing nuclear bombs from a military base, a shadowy group called the Order starts an atomic civil war with the federal government. That doesn't sound like it's an improvement of the status quo. It can hardly be a good thing that the antebellum's era of sessions with concocting increasingly bloody disunion scenarios has reappeared with fresh vigor in recent years. There have been too many next Civil War books to count, and most, true to the form, have been absolute garbage, maudlin, contrived, cliché, but not all. In Ben H. Winter's Underground Airlines, 2016, set in the 21st century United States, where slavery remains legal in four states, and the Tiddler Rescue Networks help persons bound to labor escape to Canada, the alt history is only a provocative premise for airing matters relevant in both its fictional world and our real one. What compromises hold a country together, and when are those not worth the cost? Omar El Akkad's American War, 2017, shows a country split apart at the end of the century over an attempt to ban fossil fuels. El Akkad at once lays out a clever, though thought-provoking scenario. More stable Middle Eastern powers intervene, as the U.S. often has in the civil wars of other nations, and delves into the complexities of identity, loyalty, and the human costs of civil conflict. Christopher Brown's harrowing Tropic of Kansas, 2017, paints a harrowing picture of a nation in the grip of authoritarianism and ecological collapse, and celebrates the relentless pursuit of justice in the face of overwhelming odds. Now, what do you see here? These are books that Kreitner likes because they're all leftist fantasy about what we could do to right-wingers. I mean, Kreitner is a leftist. He's certainly not against secession as an idea, as a potential outcome, in a way that could be positive. This is something you'll get out of Kreitner when you re-break it up. He's afraid of the violence, but I think at his core, he doesn't think that would be necessary. And now we have director Alex Garland's new film with a title as bland as the movie itself. Like so much in our culture right now, Civil War isn't nearly weighty enough to bear the load of discourse that's been based on it. Focus on the ethical dilemmas and psychological torments involved in war photography, which, okay, the movie takes advantage of our dark fascination with the possibility of political polarization, leading to constitutional crisis and political violence while refusing to actually explore these themes. Again, for people that are hyper-focused on these things, and I've had people comment to me on that, don't watch it. It's terrible because it doesn't really get into this stuff. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't. It doesn't explore those things, but that's the point. It's vaguely ambiguous, I think, for a reason. It's not really a... I gave you my thoughts on it yesterday. So I'll just leave it at that. For all the ear-splitting explosions and hair-raising exchanges of gunfire across a variety of modern American landscapes, and yes, the IMAX experience is intense, the film seems to be conscious of its own essentially terrible nature. There is something cheap and unseemly in the way the camera lingers on a pile of human bodies or the Lincoln Memorial blown to smithereens. Just as Southern secessionists Edmund Ruffin found writing gory scenes of executions and massacres conducive to immediate pleasure, Joel, one of the war photographers in Civil War, played by Wagner Moura, looks out on a night sky filled with arcing mortar shells and grunts, "This gunfire is getting me so excited." I'm not going to use the language that's used in the film. The viewer is meant to be implicated, and we are. Now, I think that part of it, though, the excitement behind the action, and you see that in how these people are traded. If you were to go into, if you look at the people engaged in combat, they'll talk about this, how exciting it is. They're scared, but they're excited at the same time. It's the most fun they ever had. As long as they don't get hit or killed. The viewer is meant to be implicated, and we are, but instead of any profounder meditations on why mass slaughter both attracts and sickens us, for even Joel is eventually reduced to a puddle of tears, the film offers 90 more minutes of picturesque wreckage, bone-chilling executions, and finally the eagerly painted after money shot, a phrase one of the journalists actually uses as the film's climatic scenes unfold. At least Ruffin has an excuse for pleasing himself by turning his fantasies of American carnage into art. He wanted to bring it about. Garland claims he wants his film to do the opposite, but it's strange then that a single line or moment and even implicitly alludes to what, if anything, should have been done to keep things from reaching such a breaking point. I disagree. There is the conversation in the car where the older boomer journalist says, "You're going to throw him softballs." And the reporter says, the question he asks is, "Why are you bombing American citizens?" What about the third term? What happened? There are some allusions to this. Excessive power, these kind of things. In interviews, the filmmaker has claimed as a film about the product of polarization and division. But if we are to understand that the president, played by Nick Offerman, who appears only fleetingly in the movie, has turned fascistic, right? It's turned into a fascist, as Garland explains. Claiming a third term, abolishing the FBI, bombing American citizens, why is it bad that insurgents have risen up to overthrow him? If it's not bad, how can the movie be described, as lead actress Kirsten Dunst has put it, as anti-war? That's a good question. And he does show these things, right? Third term, abolishing the FBI, which that's thrown out there. There are people that would be fine with that. This deeply unserious film was not interested in probing those tensions, or more to the point, its creator is too scared of alienating half the public by addressing them. It's neither pedantic nor partisan to object to such explosive material being used to show shallow ends. Far from deterring the violence it depicts, Civil War may well convince some content-addled moviegoers that it sure would be something to see. I don't share Kreitner's position on that. Maybe there could be some, but regardless, I think it's interesting. The most important part about this piece is all of this fiction that has been produced, even after the war. You get some things wrong about before the war, but even after the war, that this genre of dystopian breakup in America is still there because this undercurrent of disunion, I should say, has been around since, the Union was founded. When Tucker wrote The Partisan Leader in 1836, this idea of secession was floating around. And it was floating around, as Kreitner well knows, as early as the 1790s in the North. But even before that, the whole reason we had the Constitution is because there was some question of disunion and what that would be like and if it would be violent or not. It was already there. Because the Union is a fragile thing. Maybe a bad experiment. When you go back and you look at what people were saying, and you look at, the arguments over the ratification of the Constitution, the Anti-Federalists, they predicted it. Perhaps this thing shouldn't be put together because it's only going to lead to war. That might be the larger takeaway from any of this, that the Union was a bad idea from the start, at least when you gave the keys of power to a centralized authority that could abuse it, as all of these things kind of show, that could abuse it at the expense of the constituent parts. That is the problem. You got to get rid of that possibility. So, anyways, thought it was an interesting piece following up on this week and wrapping up this week, by the way. See you next time on the Brian McClanahan Show. See you then.